Good evening and welcome to the local news. Today is Wednesday, March 5th. I'm Lauren Schmidt, reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, search and rescue operation shifts to coroner's investigation. And mass firings, logging expansion, and the fight to save national parks. Stay tuned. News on those stories and more coming right up. We start tonight's news in Mendocino County, where the Mendocino County Sheriff's Office has announced that a search and rescue operation has now shifted to a recovery mission. Captain Quincy Cromer shared this update with our listeners.
I'm the Field Services Captain and Public Information Officer for the Mendocino County Sheriff's Office. I'm providing some information on a search and rescue deployment and ultimately a coroner's investigation. So on Saturday, March 1st, 2025, the Mendocino County Sheriff's Office received a report of a missing person in the Albion area. Over the next 4 days, search and rescue teams from the Mendocino County and surrounding counties conducted searches for this missing person. Yesterday, on Tuesday, March 4th, 2025, at about 11:38 in the morning, search and rescue teams located a deceased individual within the assigned search areas. The decedent's identity is being withheld pending the identification and notification of the legal next of kin for this case. No foul play is suspected at this stage of the coroner's investigation. An autopsy will be performed by a forensic pathologist today on Wednesday, March 5th, but the official cause and manner of death will not be available until all forensic examination reports and tests have been completed. Additional information regarding this investigation will be released as it becomes available, to include the name of the deceased individual once the legal next of kin has been notified.
The deceased individual is believed to be the 72-year-old Albion resident who was reported missing last weekend. However, the sheriff's office is withholding the person's name until the next of kin has been notified. KMUD News will continue to share updates. We would like to extend our heartfelt condolences to the family. As a broader push by Donald Trump to reduce the federal government's footprint, the president's Department of Government Efficiency has announced more than 700 lease terminations for federal offices across various agencies. These cancellations include dozens of offices used by energy and environmental agencies, affecting employees such as EPA scientists, National Park Service officials, and energy regulators. In addition to canceled leases, the administration has released a list of more than 400 federal buildings designated for disposal. At the Department of Interior, Trump officials are considering closing up to 164 offices nationwide, including 27% of all Bureau of Indian Affairs locations. That's according to a list released by North Coast Congressman Jared Huffman. In California, 9 offices are slated for closure, with Huffman's district, CA2, facing the most shutdowns in the state. These include the National Park Service Office in Arcata, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Services Office in Arcata, the BLM Office in Ukiah, and the Bureau of Reclamation Office in Weaverville. In response to these cuts, people are taking to the streets, from small grassroots protests at the Garberville Town Clock to larger demonstrations at the Eureka Courthouse, and even nationally courted protests, like the recent demonstration in Oreck, which opposed the mass firing of staff at Redwood National Park, home to the world's tallest trees. To learn more about this protest and how it connects to the national movement with local impacts, we spoke with its organizer.
Yeah, so my name is Emma Dindler, and I am currently a student here at Cal Poly Humboldt, as well as a social media influencer, I suppose. I'm a content creator.
On social media, Emma Dindler is known as the Simple Environmentalist, where she creates content about zero waste living. But in her personal life, she is a student at Cal Poly Humboldt and is married to a ranger at Redwood National Park, a job she fears could be at risk.
This was actually my first protest ever. And this is just an issue, a cause that means a lot to me. I have been in doing outdoorsy things my entire life since I was a child, but I got really into it post-pandemic, as I'm sure many of us did. And then once my husband and I got out of the Air Force, he actually became a park ranger. So now it's even closer to home, this issue. He was working for the National Park Service, and now he works for the Bureau of Land Management, which is why we actually moved here. And so once I knew like his job was on the line, my friends' jobs are on the line, as well as our public lands, right? The resource, the clean air, the clean water, the wildlife, the trees. It really did just have a really big impact on me. And I thought, you know, now's the time. I'm going to put my words into actions and actually get out there and make my voice heard.
Concerned about the recent dismissals of National Park Service and Forest Service employees under the Trump administration, Dendler helped organize a protest southwest of Oreck at the Redwood Creek Day Use Area in the National Park. The demonstration was part of a nationwide movement led by Resistance Rangers, a group of former and off-duty park rangers advocating for the protection of public lands and the reinstatement of fired staff.
And that was kind of the whole reason why I started this one here, is because I didn't see Redwood was on the list. And I thought, you know, this park might be small, but it has such a big impact on the community. And it has for decades. I know there's a lot of history with the Redwoods and protesting. And I thought it would just be an important cause to emphasize yet again.
The Resistance Rangers social media account describes itself as the official resistance account of National Park Rangers, representing a community of over 700 off-duty rangers rallying to save public lands. The group gained national attention when employees at Yosemite National Park made a bold statement by hanging an upside-down American flag on El Capitan, one of the park's most iconic mountains. This act of protest symbolized distress over the mass firings of National Park Service employees. In response, the group called for nationwide demonstrations at all national parks, organizing the Protect Your Parks protest. Tens of thousands of people turned out at national parks, monuments, seashores, battlefields, and historic sites across the country to protest the Trump administration's actions against public lands. The movement saw over 12,000 participants protesting at more than 170 park sites in defense of the 3,400 federal workers who were terminated in February. According to Dendler, the local effect of these cuts are already becoming evident.
Yeah, one of our close friends did lose their job, and they also moved here specifically for this job. So it was really sad to see that happen to them so quickly. And of course, you know, my husband's probationary, so he could theoretically lose his job any day. So every day he heads into work, we're anxious. Every day time he gets an email from Doge or from OPM, we're anxious. Everything's up in the air. I mean, our livelihoods, his job, everything.
She described the feeling of whiplash as some of the executive orders were either temporarily blocked by judges or rescinded, causing chaos and uncertainty. And although certain orders were suspended, she says the damage has already been done.
It's always uncertain, right? Because like, is it true? Is it not? Is it going to be reversed tomorrow? Is it going to actually go into effect? So ultimately, we just try to ignore what goes on in the media and wait for him to actually get directive from his supervisors, from his leadership. And then stuff like this reversal is also really unfortunate, because had that been passed, you know, 3 weeks ago, my friend wouldn't have lost their job. Thousands of rangers have already lost their job, and they are not going to get them back.
These events have sparked widespread outrage, prompting Humboldt residents and Redwood Park supporters to take to the streets last Saturday in Oreck, carrying signs to voice their frustration and show support for the park.
It was really, really great to see folks of all ages attend this protest, because, you know, it gives me hope that the old folks have not given up on these things, even though they still have to fight for them yet again. And it also gave me hope to see a lot of young folks out there who are inspired and ready. It was a lot of people's first protest as well. Some older folks who attended had said they've been protesting for 50 plus years, and it feels like they've come full circle in a bad way, right? Like they were protesting these same issues in the 60s and 70s. It looked like it was on the up and up for them. And now we're back here again, still fighting for the climate, still fighting for the resource, for public lands, for people's livelihoods yet again.
In another major move affecting national parks, Donald Trump has issued an executive order calling for large-scale logging across 280 million acres of national forest and public lands, bypassing regulations designed to protect endangered species. The order argues that restrictive federal policies have increased reliance on foreign timber imports and claims that expanding domestic logging is essential for national and economic security. Under this directive, the U.S. Forest Service and Bureau of Land Management have been instructed to ramp up timber production and use emergency powers to circumvent Endangered Species Act protections, potentially threatening vital wildlife habitats. This decision has sparked concerns over the destruction of ecologically significant forests across the country.
Living in an area where lumber is so prevalent, where trees are so prevalent, that does make me concerned for the environment. Right off the bat, when Trump got reelected, I knew it was not going to be good news for public lands. Simply looking at his first term, it's going to be bad news for the planet as a whole, for the ecosystems, for all of ecology.
EPIC, the Environmental Protection Information Center, agrees and has issued an action alert, warning that the Northwest Forest Plan is on the chopping block.
We've been watching President Trump's second term with great alarm.
That was Tom Wheeler, the executive director of EPIC, who has been working on protecting the forest ecosystems on the North Coast for over four decades.
And there are two things that are happening right now that KMUD listeners should know about. The first is that on Saturday, Trump issued an executive order that called for his secretaries of Interior and Agriculture, which manage the Bureau of Land Management and Forest Service, respectively, to reevaluate federal environmental laws and to propose amendments to regulations to expedite the cut, logging on federal public lands, and to the extent that existing laws continue to pose a barrier, to begin to claim emergencies necessitate ignoring federal environmental law wholesale.
Trump's plan would remove important protections for species and ecosystems, harming our region's wildlife, watersheds, and resilience to climate change.
This is so extreme that the executive order also hints that they know that species may go extinct because of this rapid increase in federal logging.
The administration is preparing to exponentially increase logging on national and public lands. And Wheeler believes their impacts will soon be felt in Northern California.
In the background is another longer-term process, and that is updates to the Northwest Forest Plan. The Northwest Forest Plan was passed in 1994 by the Clinton administration, and it governs how federal lands within the range of the northern spotted owl are to be managed. So generally, we have areas that are set aside for timber production and areas that are reserved for the development and maintenance of mature and old growth forests, the kind of forests that the northern spotted owl are going to need. The Trump administration, we fear, is likely to massively allow for new logging on what was set aside land, set aside for old growth protection. So we're returning very quickly back to some of the worst days of the timber wars. And I think that we as a community need to be ready for when these changes to environmental laws happen or when individual projects start to target some of our last remaining old growth on federal lands.
Less than 5% of the original old-growth coast redwood forests remain due to the extensive logging in the past two centuries. Notably, just before the transition of administrations on January 7th, the Biden administration announced that it was abandoning its proposed National Old-Growth Amendment. And while that decision was met with mixed emotions, Wheeler says it may have been a move to safeguard the forest.
Is that this Republican Congress would have overturned any rule that the Biden administration had passed protecting old growth through something called the Congressional Review Act. And so it is a disappointment to EPIC, who have been advocating for federal protections of old growth specifically, that we didn't get such a rule passed. But we understand the political calculus here. because if it was overturned by Congress through the Congressional Review Act, that would prohibit any future administration from doing anything similar without the approval of Congress. Now, we just have to wait at least 4 years.
With the rapid signing of executive orders and the administration signaling that this shift in climate policy is just beginning, we ask Wheeler whether the forest can withstand 4 more years of destructive policies, and how EPIC will respond to address these changes.
We have survived bad times before as an environmental movement. You know, we survived Reagan, we survived Bush, we survived the first Trump term. I think that this second Trump term is more savvy in the way that they are approaching things and more ruthless as well in the way that they're approaching things. So I think the threat here is greater. And so it's going to be kind of all hands on deck and all tools in the toolbox. So EPIC, we're good at doing environmental laws, environmental lawsuits, you know, working with lawyers and using what we still have in the judiciary to fight back. And so that's going to be our role. I think that there is roles for other folks. Particularly, we have a great history in Humboldt County of civil disobedience to protect precious places. And so, you know, I am not calling for folks to return to the forest yet, but I can foresee a future in which, you know, blockades and tree sits and civil disobedience is a tool that could be utilized to protect public lands. And so, again, you know, that's not EPIC. We're the legal arm of the environmental movement. But there are a lot of folks in the K-Mud listening audience who helped defend old growth at Palco, who have been on federal timber sale blockades. Those skills are going to come in handy.
To learn more about EPIC and their fight for old growth, you can visit wildcalifornia.org. K-Mud News will continue to share updates. KMUD is currently holding its spring membership drive with the theme Education by the People for the People. This week, KMUD News is highlighting this theme and those who put it into action here on the North Coast and beyond. Tonight, we feature Janine Jackson, the program director of FAIR, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, and the host and producer of FAIR's syndicated radio show, Counterspin, which airs every Sunday at 1 p.m. here on KMUD.
FAIR started in 1986, and I know that for a lot of listeners, that's a long time ago. But at that time, news media, which is what FAIR focuses on, news media were not really thought of as anything it's controversial or complicated. In other words, news was something that was delivered to you as a service, as a citizen, and it was free of constraints. It was basically, this is what happened today that you needed to learn about. And so when FAIR, and obviously not FAIR alone, but when we stepped into the conversation in 1986, our message was to say, you know, the news that you're getting, the information that you're getting that is telling you not just what is happening around the world, but how to feel about it, that information is coming from corporations that are for-profit corporations. The stations that you're listening to are owned by those corporations, and the advertisers that are sponsoring that news program are also for-profit corporations. And so FAIR's message was just to say, be vigilant, be aware of the fact that this is not news from nowhere, that the factors, the forces that are bringing information about the world to you have interests, have influences. They want you to feel a certain way about things, and they would rather you not feel another way about things. And so in our general message is about corporate influence, the fact that newspapers, radio stations, TV stations are owned by for-profit corporations, and understanding the effects of that, the influence of that on the day-to-day coverage of the news has been very, very important to us. So it's a little bit of a complicated conversation, but I can say if no one hears anything else, We need to support community media that is neither influenced overwhelmingly by corporate dollars or by government.
Janine, some of our listeners hear Corporation for Public Broadcasting, or CPB, and associate it with, quote, corporate media. We often emphasize that we don't have any corporate donors, but when they learn that 25% of our funding comes from the CPB, some assume the worst. Can we start there, and can you explain what CPB is and how it operates, and why it is critical to community stations like ours?
CPB was created as a way to insulate public broadcasters from political intimidation. You know, we talk a lot about corporate influence, and of course that's important. But if you go back to 1967, the idea was we're going to create a space to hear voices and perspectives that commercial outlets don't want to support. And let me just sidestep and say this is a tiny amount of funding. Public radio and public media and get a tiny amount of funding from the public government. But even that amount of funding was considered a congressional football. And so the point is, ever since it started, it's been twisted against that goal. It's been used as instead a political tool, you know, to push PBS, to push NPR, to bend over backwards, to provide programming that is more hospitable to the right, because they're the ones who are saying, hey, if you don't do that, we'll cut off your funding.
With the current threats we're seeing, many of the stations that air Counterspin are facing a period of uncertainty regarding funding. I'm sure you've read much of the Project 2025 text, which explicitly aims to eliminate public media funding. What is the goal behind this effort? Why would this administration want to defund public media? And what are the broader implications of that decision?
It's hard to understand, given the tiny percentage of money, first of all, taxpayer money, that goes to public media, again, versus other countries. But also, when you look at the content of public media, what is it that they're so mad about? Well, one of the things public media do, that they deliver news to remote, small, rural regions, right? To places that would not be profitable for a commercial to produce for. So public media reach people who wouldn't be otherwise reached. They cover topics, you know, that are not necessarily attractive to advertisers and public media owners. So they fill a void, and they cover communities that are traditionally ignored by mainstream news organizations. Why does this current administration see that as a threat? We're not talking necessarily about the content of what these outlets say. We're talking about where they are. You know, some of them, it's like, well, they're rural regions, they're remote regions, you know, they're communities. Why are we silencing whole communities and whole regions, you know, in a way that we're pretending is not about censorship? So again, I would send people back to real data about the percentage of public media that comes from the government, and it's tiny. It's tiny. So before you even get yourself tangled up in an argument about public broadcast, what they do, ask whoever you're arguing with, wait, what are we talking about? How much money are we talking about? Because it's a tiny fraction of money. And what it tells us is they're afraid of what, forget public, they're afraid of what independent news media will do and can do. It's about ensuring that media are responsive to community and not responsive to powerful corporate actors or owners. It's not easy. It's a conversation that we need to have, but I think at this point we do understand what we don't want. And what we don't want is the U.S. government saying, we're going to decide whether or not you deserve to keep your license based on the content that we see you producing and whether or not it agrees with us. And that's why I always say to folks who have a community radio station that they listen to, but they're like, you know what, every Tuesday they do this show and I really hate it. It's like, you're not calling for support for voices that you agree with. You're calling for support for spaces, platforms that exist where you can possibly hear voices that are counter to the powerful forces in society who in 2025 are deeply, deeply invested in shutting you up, which is why we have to support truly independent media, which might be reliant on your $5.
That was our KMUD Membership Drive Special News Spotlight, featuring Janine Jackson, the Program Director of Fair, Fairness, and Accuracy in Reporting, and the host and producer of Counterspin. You can hear this interview in full during next Tuesday's Public Affairs Special at 5:30 p.m., just before the local news. In national news, Democrats sue to prevent Trump's takeover of the Federal Elections Commission. Catherine Carley reports.
We have accomplished more in 43 days than most administrations accomplished in 4 years or 8 years, and we are just getting started.
In a contentious address to Congress Tuesday night, President Donald Trump touted his actions at the border, tariffs, and efforts to root out government waste. A Democratic member was ejected after shouting that Trump had no mandate. After that, Trump criticized his opponents in the chamber. Just 6 weeks into his presidency, thousands of federal workers have been fired and programs cut, provoking dozens of lawsuits. Since he announced tariffs on Canada and Mexico, the stock market has fallen sharply. One Trump executive order takes control of all independent agencies, including the Federal Election Commission. Democrats have sued, warning Trump could have partisan influence on elections. Former FEC Chairwoman Ellen Weintraub says Trump wants to prevent the public from knowing who's funding political candidates.
There is already too much dark money in our system, and without an FEC, there would be even more. Basically, all of it would be dark, and there would be no one out there to enforce the law.
Voting rights advocates say a Trump plan to take over the Postal Service could put blocks in the way of mail-in voting, which he's accused of being riddled with fraud. Brian Renfro with the National Association of Letter Carriers says the public's confidence in mail-in voting is tied to its trust in postal workers.
I think it's very clear this administration has no interest in protecting public service, working people, or really the public good.
Civil rights groups say they're alarmed by the SAVE Act, which would require in-person proof of citizenship with a birth certificate or passport to register to vote. Driver's licenses, military, student, or tribal IDs would not be accepted. And Sarah Harris with the nonprofit Stand Up America says a passport can cost hundreds of dollars.
This in itself is essentially a poll tax, because updating these documents costs money and time, and we shouldn't have to pay anything, even if it means getting a passport, to vote.
Meanwhile, House GOP leaders have advised their members to avoid in-person public town hall events in their districts as protests against government cuts spread nationwide. Maine Governor Janet Mills says the state expects to sue the Trump administration for attacks on transgender athletes. Dusty Homan Sprague with Maine Women's Lobby says activists there and in other states are working to expand protections in the state's constitution now that the federal Equal Rights Amendment won't be enacted.
There is a lot of energy because people are seeing that their rights are at stake right now, and they want to do everything that they can to protect those rights in Maine's constitution.
I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thank you for listening. Thanks to our engineer, Larry Lashley. And thanks to our reporter, Catherine Carley. Reporting from our studio in Redway, I'm Lauren Schmidt.